Hello, everyone, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. My name is Omar Sadr, and I am Senior Research Scholar at University of Pittsburgh's Center for Governance and Markets. The collapse of the Republic of Afghanistan triggered several intellectual debates on how and why the political order collapsed. The immediate answer, of course, was the withdrawal of the U.S. troops. But the answer lies beyond this. In a fascinating book titled Inside Afghanistan, Political Network and Informal Order and State Disruption, published this year, Dr. Timur Sharan proposes a nuanced framework to understand how and why Afghanistan's 2001 to 2021's political order, or at least the facade of a political order, maintained when the state institutions were so weak and fragmented and struggling to provide basic services for their citizens. According to him, the answer lies in the network dynamic of the power. The book's proposed political and network approach to understand conflict management and state building differs from the dominant analysis of politics and statehood, which looks at the rule and behavior of elites, identity-based divisions. So I'm lucky today to have Dr. Timur Sharan with me in this episode. Dr. Timur Sharan, welcome to Negotiating Ideas.
Thank you for having me.
So let me begin with a very general question and give us and the audience an overview of your book, what this book is about, and what are the key contributions in terms of probably policy or theory, if you'd like to discuss.
Sure. Well, this book makes an academic and theoretical contribution to the study of Afghanistan, in particular the last two decades, with the U.S.-led American international intervention, to the study of international state building and the political economy of the state. I take a political economy and a political cultural lens to understand statehood and governance in the last two decades in Afghanistan. I look at how resources flow and by whom, and how those cultural expectations reinforced a system of reciprocity and so forth. So these are some of the questions. But I guess it makes five key contributions. First, in relation to Afghanistan, most academics and experts working on Afghanistan have tried to examine governance and statehood in the last four or five decades through the narrow lens of elite politics and its dynamics, including political settlement that goes in relation to the literature that emerged in the 1980s. And then that literature shifted to identity politics, including clan politics, ethnicity, and tribal politics. In post-2001, the literature shifted to a discussion of strongman politics or warlord politics and their role in the process of state building. And subsequently, discussions around patronage politics has emerged. What I have done, patronage politics, and then arguing that what we have inherited is a new patrimonial state in Afghanistan. What I have done, and I think that's the main contribution of this book, is that I have shifted this discussion to highlighting the role of political networks. And I have called it network politics. And I have shown how a network state emerged in post-2000 Afghanistan, which had historical and sociological features through the process of state formation in Afghanistan. Network politics is an all-compassing mode of governance. It includes elements of identity politics, strongman politics, patronage, and so forth. But it encompasses all of it. And through empirical chapters and cases, I try to provide a framework through which I show that taking a network lens gives us a better understanding of how politics and the statehood operated in Afghanistan. So that's the main contribution of the book. The second contribution is around the role of political networks. And what I mean here, which I'm happy to discuss later, is the emergence of network forms of organizations. I draw on the work of political management, organizational theory, in particular, Abdelbaker Sino's work on organizations at war, and show how military political organizations emerged in the 1980s and 90s in Afghanistan, and since then have shaped the nature of governance in Afghanistan. And of course, ultimately the collapse of the Republic in August 2021. The third contribution is around what are some of the rules of the game in which these political networks operate in terms of day-to-day operation, and what does that tell us around political cultural rules, rules such as Wasatan and Diwali, and I'll be happy to discuss those, and more political economy rules such as rent-seeking, coercion, intimidation, and politicization of identity, how they operate within these rules. Two more. The fourth, for me, the key question was, how did informal order or violence or lack of informal order emerged in post-2000 Afghanistan? Or as you put it, the facade of an order at the national level, with significant disruption and violence at the subnational level, it emerged. And how Karzai, for instance, was successful to some extent in maintaining a stable order through equilibrium among political networks, whereas the National Unity Government led by Ashraf Ghani miserably failed on that front and tried to disrupt those political networks and the rules of the game, which eventually led to the eventual collapse of the state. And finally, this is an empirically rich book which draws on decades or the last decades of my own work in Afghanistan, both as an analyst working for International Crisis Group, but also as a former senior bureaucrat working for the Afghan Republic. So it provides a lot of empirical evidence around the key actors, how they operated, how financial flows took place beyond Afghanistan, and so forth.
Well, indeed, it is an empirically rich book. And I would love to discuss some of those aspects that you discussed here. But before that, let's talk about the concept, the network politics. And when I read the book, my assumption or my understanding was, probably I'm wrong, but the concept has been applied through various forms of organizations, through various forms of institutions, to various forms of political parties or any other dynamics of power. And it does not apply only to the post-2001 political order, but you try to explain the history of Afghanistan, right, from the modern history, last 100 years, through the lens of network politics. It seems to the reader that you try to push the entire history to just this concept or framework. And that, to me, brings the challenge in comparative politics we have, where some scholars call it conceptual stretching, where you take the concept to the ladder of generality to the extreme, that it may lose its nuance. So that's what, can you explain how can we, for example, avoid that problem? For example, of course, political parties in Afghanistan are not as developed as it is in the West. And hence, you have this concept of informal order, and that informal order is not with respect to the state, but all sorts of other political organizations. But do you think the concept that you use here for network politics is a stretched to extreme, that it may lose its own nuance and meaning?
That's a very good question, and I take your point. Probably it does. It is used loosely. I agree, but I don't think it makes an extreme generalization by stretching the concept. I think the centrality of the concept is around the role of network forms of organizations, and then looking at the process of state formation in the last two and a half century, and identifying elements and features that reinforced the emergence of the network state or network politics. So, I'm saying this is not new. The network state has always existed from the very foundation in 1947 onwards, when the state, through concession to particular tribal groupings and ethnic groupings, emerged. And the concept of Sardar, you're aware of, and the militarization of those Sardars. But then it took its modern elements, which comes in the concept of rent-seeking, a rentier state, and so forth. But the particular focus in the last five decades, and that's where it's not necessarily new. The concept of network, I agree with you, has been used loosely, not just by me, but in most of the fields, whether that is institutional theory, organizational theory, or management theory. But it has proven to be its usage very effective. So what I look at, particularly I look at Sino's work, which his work on organizations at war, he talks about network forms of organizations being instrumental in the success of the Mujahideen or Jihadi Tanzims or political military organizations. And that's when I build up his work in post 2001 Afghanistan to say that how they have changed and transformed in post 2001 Afghanistan with significant amount of money pumped in by the Americans and the involvement of international state peace building in Afghanistan, state building in Afghanistan. And then subsequently how that further reinforced and consolidated the network state that was already, elements of it existed in the past. Having said that, the concept of network state has been used before in relation to Russia and a few other contexts before, so it's nothing new. But I tried to tie up the concept by providing a specific definition of what I mean by network, and that definition is: political networks are characterized as distinct, open hierarchical structures whose members are reliant on one another's power resources, and that could mean symbolic powers, power of mobilization, military power, financial power, and so forth, for political outcomes in an informally structured and continuously renegotiated arrangement. So I've tried to provide that definition, but I agree, and I hope that others could come in and further develop this concept and what I've proposed. I mean, one area that I think would definitely strengthen this the notion of a network state and network politics is to look at how local networks connect better with national networks, which I have done to some extent, but not necessarily, you know, with the time frame I had, effectively in showcasing that.
Sure. So you discuss in the book that political networks, not necessarily it weakens the state, because you identify different patterns. You come up with one pattern, which you call it a balanced network equilibrium, which is relatively stable political order. But that becomes unstable when it turns to a fragmented authority, or one of the, for example, the parties in the network probably change the shift of power balance. So in case of, if we apply this prism in current dynamics, the Taliban, how do you see network politics can help us to understand Taliban? Because what comes to my mind is also Taliban, their rational coming to power was against network politics of 90s. They build on rhetorically. They build on how fragmented 90s was, the civil war, the the criminalities and almost at all levels of society. So they came up to disturb that fragmented political order, and the state established a very consolidated one. But at the same time, we understand that Taliban as a terrorist organization, as an insurgency, and now as an incumbent state, they're also formed of multiple networks. So how they manage, how they have been able to present a form of, is it a kind of balanced network equilibrium, if I can characterize them? How do you see that?
That's a good question. So what I propose is like four different types of order. And again, people have used it in different contexts, and I'm not saying this is anything new, but in relation to Afghanistan, this discussion is new. So I've looked at where informal order emerged historically and where disruption has happened. So until 1973, in relation to Afghanistan, we can say that whenever there was a balanced equilibrium amongst competing forces, centers of power and networks, and the leader who succeeded in maintaining that balance were effective in sustaining an order, whether that is the first Ahmad Shah Abdali, Timur Shah, Dost Mohammad Khan, the second period, and so forth. And then in post 2001, Karzai was successful in that. The disruptive ones like Daoud Khan and the communists and others who have tried to centralize instead of maintaining an order, going against the logic of network state, tried to centralize that, disrupt the rules of the power, it has led to violence and significant either disruption or complete collapse of the state. So Ashraf Ghani, for instance, tried to disrupt the rules of the game and completely shifted the power balance, and subsequently, I argue, led to the eventual collapse of the republic, in addition to other factors that was in play. In relation to the Taliban, so that's the historical lesson that we can learn. Obviously, one other period that the state remained stable and order emerged was during Abdurrahman Khan, with significant brutality and coercion. So again, one consolidated network emerges as a centralized force, controlling, capturing the state completely and enforcing coercion, and a monopoly, having the only monopoly of use of violence, which Abdurrahman Khan from 20th century had. So that's another form of order. Places like Cambodia, you see multiple competing networks initially starting in a place like Cambodia, Tajikistan, but eventually one political network emerges as the one with solid control of monopoly of violence. In relation to Taliban, what we see so far, I think, is some degree of equilibrium among competing networks, whether it's the Haqqani network, the sort of Kandahari Helmandis and Western and Northern players. There has been some degree of political equilibrium. What is shifting, it seems, is that they're trying to centralize. At least the Kandaharis Helmandis are trying to dominate and emerge as the dominant network. And I think that's where the significant disruption happens if it's not managed well. And I don't think the Taliban do have the capacity to manage this well. So with centralization, I think we'll see significant disruption and possibly the collapse of the Taliban as a unified entity. But at the moment, it seems that they are able to maintain some degree of equilibrium among competing forces.
Sure. And then you discuss four key elements which leads to that
a political network to be effective.
To be effective and get together. And that is the leadership, the trust, mutual interdependencies, and common purpose. But now in terms of Taliban, you only highlighted the rule of centralization of power by the southerners that may disturb the equilibrium. So how do you see these other factors, for example, in terms of common purpose. The Taliban seems to be having an ideology which is quite strong in terms of mobilization, in terms of giving a sense of purpose for the polity or the organization itself. And in terms of mutual interdependence, the other networks, those who may not be around the Amir al-Mu'mineen of Taliban, still has that dependency towards each other. How do you see that?
First of all, let's not confuse network or the concept that the discussion that I propose in the book, which is around network effectiveness versus what might work in putting a network together. Okay, so for a network together to come together and operate, it's either built around trust, mutual interdependency, common purpose, and so forth, which again I draw on management theory discussion from management theory. But for a network to be effective, it needs to have at least two of the four resources. So for me, when I looked in post 2001 in particular, actually in the last five decades, when I look at political network, I asked the question, which one succeeded and which one struggled? And those who succeeded, first of all, the most important issue for the operation of political network is the mutual interdependency over resources. And again, it could be military resources, it could be community mobilization, it could be access to financial or coercion and so forth. So, a network needs to have at least two of these to succeed. So let me give you an example. Jumbish Islami as a political network was successful around two fronts in post-2001. One, the ability to mobilize around a particular ethnic community that it had embedded, that it had a claim to represent, and they were very successful in mobilization, especially during election. So they had one very good card. The second, it had a degree and control over violence, okay, through coercion and intimidation, a significant part of the country. So that ensured that they were successful. But were they financially successful in accumulating wealth? I don't think so. Whereas Jamiat was very successful in having wealth and control and ability to exert violence. So the same thing applies with other political networks that I've talked about, whether it's Hizb-e-Wahdat and others. Now, in relation to the Taliban, the Taliban seems to have, at this stage, the ability to control and exert significant monopoly over violence. In fact, they have been quite successful on that front. I'm not sure to what extent they're successful in maintaining ties with communities and instrumentalizing identity-based division. Well, I'll come back to that because they have been successful in using ethnic politics to some degree. I don't know much about patron-client relationship and their ability to distribute wealth through wider networks that they have. I mean, I hear that they have been struggling to pay people, their foot soldiers and so forth. But at least on the three levels, they have been very successful. Also at wealth accumulation, they've been very successful. What distinguishes the Taliban from other political networks that I've identified in the book that have essentially faded out now, whether it's Jumbish, Jamiat and others, they have essentially disappeared, is two things, two exceptionalism. One is an ideological exceptionalism, which the Taliban enjoy through madrasas and hijras, again, the form of madrasas in southern Afghanistan and in Pakistan, which in the last five decades, and in particular the last two decades, with the U.S. military intervention, they have been very effective in mobilizing parts of Afghan society or having those ideological foot soldiers in place that they could mobilize any moment through those madrasas. The Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Amir can shout, issue a decree, and thousands and thousands of student madrasa students from Pakistan and Afghanistan would be ready to be there to exert the monopoly of violence across the country. So they have that exceptionalism, ideological exceptionalism. The second is an ethnic exceptionalism, which they have been not shy of actually making that prominent in the last 2 years, that they are not only have an ideological element, but also representing a particular ethnic politics, and they believe in the control and dominance of that ethnic group across Afghanistan. I mean, recently, the spokesperson for the Taliban came out and said, well, it's the majority of Afghanistan is one particular ethnic group. Therefore, why shouldn't be the entire cabinet from one particular ethnic group? So I think those exceptionalism makes things very complicated, which, again, I have to go back and redraw, you know, that framework to see how this could apply further to the Taliban, which I haven't really done.
But what about the implications of this framework for the sake of state reformation? I do not want to put a teleological framework here to say that, well, at the end goal of us should be a Weberian rational state bureaucratically. But if we have to transform politics of Afghanistan from such sort of network politics, which is, of course, amalgamation of rent-seeking, corruption, warlordism, identity politics, right, to a form of political order, which is, if not, I mean, fully that Weberian European style, but a political system which accommodates diversity and establish plurality, but at the same time respects political order, and it's stable. Because I'm asking this question because Afghanistan has always been in this cycle of state collapse. It's not government collapse, but it's continuous collapse of states. So that seems that network politics has been quite disturbing, as you have highlighted in your book title. So what is the way out then?
I mean, it takes me back to Douglass's North and other big giants of political science who have written about political order and how to move away from it. I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, Douglass North talks about limited access order. I draw on that and state capture. I mean, for me, one of the biggest question is how do you avoid state capture, both at the national level and subnational level? How do you avoid a situation of Cambodia or Tajikistan where a particular group of elites have access to state resources, the country's resources, and then limits it within a particular group of elites? Now, if I may take a historical lens here, it seems that the history of essentially most countries, including European Western countries, started with a limited access order, but they managed to make that transition. I think a number of things are important. Several factors are important. One is, how do you create the right incentive to change the behavior of your elites, actors, the key actors? How do you embed them in the political process, in create economic incentives for them to change their incentives and enable them to invest in key industries that would generate economic growth and so forth? And I can give you an example of South Korea, Japan, and others that essentially with mafia families were encouraged by the state to invest in key industries. And I think one of the key reasons for the success of these countries. I mean, from big brands like Samsung and others, they started as mafia families, but then the state changed their incentive, encouraged, nudged them to invest in key industries. And I think I had this conversation with Afghan officials when I was in the government, that look, especially in national unity government, that this approach of being disruptive, trying to enfranchise the strong men in the, you know, across the country wouldn't work. I think what might work is these are wealthy individuals who are taking their money to Dubai and Turkey and other places to invest, Caribbean as well, now that I my recent research is looking at them. How do we encourage them to come and invest in key industries? So you create new infant industries that could enable economic growth and subsequently change their behavior. And these actors would not be in place for long, but creating a successful economic organization could be one way to change their behavior. The second was, for me, how do you change the rules of the game in which they operate? If the rules of the game are cultural, political, wasita, that the entire society operates on that, that I need a job, therefore I go to my, you know, local mullah and ask him to take me to a provincial governor's office to secure a job. You use that connection. Or and Diwali among the elites, that informal culture of reciprocity, where I'm doing this for you, you need to do this for me. Or that rent-seeking or politicization of ideas. So how do you change those rules of the game in which these actors operate and come up with new institutional setup and design that would enable us to make gradual shift by being smart and establishing credible institutions? So in one of the chapters, I talk about elections and how electoral institutions in Afghanistan were captured predominantly by presidency, whoever the president was, appointing his key people in the electoral institution. Of course, other networks had their own key players, but it was the presidency that often able to have its the last say. And what it meant was that those institutions, those bodies were often politicized, and elections consistently went bad. Fraud was widespread, and it was always contested. So then the argument is, how do you gradually create an institutional setup like electoral bodies, an electoral body that resolve disputes, which we never had, to ensure that elections are not questioned. And finally, and again, that's I'm not necessarily my area of expertise, but we have example of successful countries who have smartly done institutional setup and design and been very successful. Thirdly, and maybe I end here, how do we bring power and decision making closer to the people, to communities, and give them a sense of ownership? That's something we failed miserably in Afghanistan historically, and especially in the last two decades. We were not able to create structures and institutions at the local level and link them to the national level so that people's voices are heard, that they felt empowered, that they are part of the decision-making process, that they have ownership of programs that came to the village, and that they were empowered. Look at the National Solidarity Program. It was effective at the village level as a program, but politically it never linked to the district level, provincial level, and national level structures. So we never deconcentrated power and decision making to the population. And I think that's key to the success of shifting, widening access and enabling communities to be part of the process. And again, that means thinking seriously about a political modality in which takes into account Afghanistan's diversity, both around ethnicity, tribe, but also communities, and ensure that people's voices are heard.
Unheard. And in other words, one can say that the state is not about mere coercion of forces, but it is a sociological entity where its strength comes from how it establishes and connects with the society. So society state dynamics are quite important rather than looking at it only through a lens of institutions, and that also formal institutions. But it's also connected to this. There is a side of dilemma between from political economic perspective, which says that if we at the local level recognize the informal institutions which are there at the community level, the risk is that there might be a day that all sorts of dirty politics, including rent-seeking, corruption, which exists at the central level, and the formal institutions, that might gradually transfer to those local-level institutions, which are currently, for example, informal, but once they are integrated within the state institutions as a formal, that will also be diluted. So, of course, the dilemma remains whether we should recognize the integrity of those informal institutions at the local level and give them much more autonomy, or integrate them within the formal state institutions, which might have this risk. What do you say about that?
I think it's a combination of both. As a person who worked on local governance, I do strongly believe that informal institutions are entrenched, are significant and important, and not necessarily a bad thing. Okay, because the tendency from someone sitting in Kabul is always, well, you know, it's those informal institutions, it's those communities who don't understand how things operate. So Kabul can dictate things. At the same time, it's important for the center not to dominate and control and dictate. That there is a space for negotiation. There's space for making mistakes and learning from it. I personally believe that those informal community structures are important. They'll probably be captured in the first decade or so, but communities learn, and because it's smaller scale, by learning those lessons. And from those mistakes, you move away from capture. So it will probably be captured, village community councils, which we had in the constitution, never materialized, with village councils. But maybe the first round for a couple of years, the second round, but the third round, people will be familiar will have the long perspective to things rather than short term. The problem was we never gave the space and the time for communities to explore those. And we were never smart and innovative to see how informal structures that we have historically inherited and to some extent have been successful, like Mirab as an institution, where water management, you know, as an informal institution, we never embed them in the formal processes. So That's your answer. But let me take a bigger picture. Look, in relation to Afghanistan and most conflict-driven countries, I do believe we ought to focus on three things. What we need to ask ourselves: what are the key objectives around which we could do institutional design, constitution, electoral processes, the modality for political parties, the modality for political system, and so forth. It needs to do three things. Okay, first, in places like Afghanistan, it has to do conflict resolution and conflict containment. It's a multi-tribal country, hundreds of tribes, and multi-ethnic country. So it has to do conflict containment and conflict resolution. We have to be able to contain conflict at the village level, at a district level, and do not allow the conflict over water and land, small conflict, to exacerbate across the country, because one particular tribe that is in Kandahar suddenly is in Faryab and other places and has the ability to mobilize the entire tribe. Okay, so how do you contain those conflicts? That should be one of the key questions for all of us. The second objective should be economic growth and service delivery. How do you do economic growth? There are fantastic models. I mean, one thing we looked at when I was in the government, how do you develop regional development authorities based from countries like Indonesia, in France and others that had developed Turkey and had developed successful regional development authorities for several provinces to come together, pool resources, and link it smartly with the regional powers. I would always give that example when I went to Turkmenistan. The Ishkapal city was built by the Turkmens had invested $20 billion on Ishkapal city, a city of marbles, because they had bought their marbles from Iran, Turkey, and in Italy. When we had the best marble in Helmand, but we had zero export to Turkmenistan because we were not able to pool resources at the regional level and then direct it smartly to specific sectors and countries. The third one is political participation and voice, which I noted earlier. So those are the three objectives. And with those objectives, then you can do smart political design and institutional reform that would reflect. Your political system needs to reflect the diversity of Afghanistan, the ability to do conflict containment at the village, at district level. So I would always say, look, community shuras are not necessarily a bad thing. If you have in Panjwai district in Kandahar, where you have 5-6 tribes and they're constantly fighting over who is going to be the district governor, why don't we set up a jirga, a shura for a week for the state to pay the elders to come together and then through a collective deliberate process, elect one person. And of course, there will be mistakes. But then Kabul doesn't need to interfere in the local process and the selection of a district governor. You can do so many other things. District demarcations are not really reflect the diversity of Afghanistan. That is why it produces a lot of conflict. You really need to redraw your district maps, your provincial maps. You need to ask yourself, do you really need so many districts? Do you really need so many provinces in Afghanistan? What can we do differently? How can we learn from other contexts? And so many other factors. Political system, as I mentioned, do we need a really centralized political system that doesn't reflect the reality of Afghanistan, and so forth? So
that's right. So that reminds me the deliberative democracy theory, which emphasizes on some of the radical deliberative democrats who emphasize on many publics. Many publics are the realm of civil society where people get together, but they have that authority to deliberate, but also informed decision making. And so this informed decision making is based on some sort of rationality, which is not instrumental, but as Habermas pointed out, it is a rationality which is embedded into decision-making processes, and that empowers people. So that's something that we have to work in Afghanistan and post-Taliban Afghanistan. Anyway, but I am very glad to have you here, and it was a fascinating discussion. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.